and welcome back to the Her Sport Six Nations show, brought to you in association with Opal, proud sponsors of Irish rugby. This week we'll be recapping on round four of the Six Nations, and Hannah, to start with the Ireland and England game, not the huge scoreline we would have feared. England have put well over 50 points on teams before. What did you make of the match?
Yeah, look, I suppose there was a lot of talk, myself included, about a potential scoreline that could have, you know, been a new record for England over Ireland. You know, England playing some very good rugby this tournament, and Ireland haven't been at their best. And I'm very glad to say that I was wrong, and that my prediction of England maybe putting a very big scoreline on us, you know, and I'm 48-0 is nothing to celebrate from an Irish point of view. Look, the players are very disappointed. Obviously, they want to put in good performances and try and get results, and they go into every game hoping and believing that they can win every game. But it is certainly an improvement that we saw in certain aspects of the game. There's definitely still things they need to tidy up a little bit and focus on. My biggest worry for this Irish team is that they're not scoring enough points. You know, we've only scored one try through Nicola Friday in round one, you know, and we've only scored 15 points overall in this whole tournament, and we have a huge game next weekend against Scotland, and my issue is that we just don't seem to be functioning very well in attack. Our lines of running, there's not enough deception there. Our handling and our accuracy isn't where it's supposed to be, and a big thing is that we're not retaining possession enough. Look, against England, as I mentioned, the first half didn't really go to plan. We were spirited. We had a lot of passion. Like, we were putting our bodies on the line in defence and making some really, really big tackles and forcing England into errors and frustrating them at the breakdown, which is what we really want to see. And we're just getting nothing on the other side of that then. We weren't turning those errors and that frustration from an English point of view into points for this Irish team. And looking ahead to Scotland, you know, that's a worry for us. But look, take nothing away from England. They didn't have their best game, you know, and they rested a couple of key players in some key positions, but they still had some world-class players. They were able to welcome back the likes of Ellie Kildon from injury. You know, their back three, their back row of Packer, Cabea and Matthews, you know, is probably the strongest they have available to them right now. And they were able to slice us open in key moments, and despite all the mistakes they made, they still scored 8 tries against us. But from an Irish perspective, a lot of positives to take, particularly in that start of that second half. There was a 20-minute period where we kept England scoreless. We actually had a lot of possession ourselves. We just weren't clinical enough to execute in key moments. We had 3 or 4 lineouts in their 22 where, you know, we'd be hoping to come away with some points, but unfortunately our lineout was a massive area that's not functioning well for us, and it's a huge turnover for us in those areas, and we're back to defending, which is physically tiring. And when you do that against the top team of the world, they will punish you, and they obviously had a massively impactful bench to come off and do some damage on that pitch, the likes of like Amber Reid, who's been injured for a while, to come off the bench. Sarah Byrne, probably best prop in the world right now, able to come off the bench for England, you know, and there's a reason they're the best team in the world, and they're getting that fruition of having been a professional team for so long. And they're a team that Ireland hopefully will aspire to be like in a couple of years, when we're fully in that professional system and, you know, we're learning from that and growing each year.
And we've talked about it week on week, how we have had possession but haven't been able to do anything with it. What is the issue there, you know, as a former player looking on? Is it in the way we attack? Is it maybe there's just a lack of trust there with passing? What's actually the issue there when you're looking at the match?
I don't think there's one single issue that can sum up everything that doesn't seem to be going right for Irish rugby. There's a mix of like individuals needing to take responsibility and making sure that they're able to pass on both sides under pressure, you know, that they're getting their running lines right and their timings of their running line. For me, from a deception point of view, like, we want to run teams around in defence and make them unsure of what we're going to do next. And at times we just look like it's really, really easy to figure out where the ball is going. So like, for example, if we have a ball carrier with the ball and someone outside them who's ready to run a short line, we also want someone out the back to be that extra option. But when you're running that short line, whether you're getting the ball or not, you need to be running and trying to make the defence believe that you are getting the ball, because that opens up space for the player out the back. And vice versa, if it's going short, the player out the back needs to be really animated and running a really good line to hopefully catch the eyes of that England defender. And there's just not just that, like that's a very simple out the back pass or short pass, but there's just simple things. Our switch lines, our timing needs to be better, our timing of the passes, our depth can sometimes, we're either too flat or too deep and therefore not able to take advantage. That will come over time, but that's an individual responsibility to be working on that, both like just you or in like pods of two or three where you can focus on that. A big thing for me, if we're looking at a bigger picture, is the line out needing to function. It's been a strength of Irish rugby for so long. And when you win a penalty and you want to relieve pressure, you want to kick the ball up the line and have possession further up there. But when we get up there, we're just throwing that possession away. And I don't want to be blaming this on the hooker. It is a lot of pressure, but it seems to me that maybe they're trying out a few new line outs, and between the throws and the lifts and jumps, it's just not going to plan. And it's a waste of possession for us, and we're just inviting pressure back on ourselves. You know, all of this will take time, but there are some basic errors like handling, literally just concentration of catching a high ball or catching a pass that's given, or, you know, knowing your role in a certain set piece move. And that's the stuff that needs to be worked on, you know, and can be worked on from a daily point of view, but it might take longer than, you know, might come too soon for this weekend's game.
And in that line out, it was something the commentators pointed out as well, but they seem to only be using Nicola Friday as an option. You know, even at a club level, you'd have two or three players to, you know, to keep the defensive side guessing. Why is that? And what's the kind of issue with just having Nicola there?
Yeah, I suppose, again, there's a variety of reasons for that. So every team will have one line-out leader or line-out caller, and they're the one who makes the decisions. And the decision they have to make is based on, well, what can my hooker hit? What's the situation? Like, do we need this ball back quickly? Are we willing to take a risk kind of on this? And do we need to move this defensive team around? Like, I'm no means, side note, not an expert in the line-out. But I suppose there's a variety of issues that needs to be made. And what makes a really good, effective set piece is having options. So ideally, most teams would have their 2 second rows as a jumper and maybe two of their back rows so that they can create lots of movement in the line out, and other teams are unsure of who's actually going to be lifted, because the last thing you want is a contested lift or a stolen line out. Unfortunately, it seems like between our hooker and our jumpers, we've little option in terms of maybe we can't throw to the back, or we become less accurate when we throw to the middle or back, and so therefore we tend to throw to the front. And when we're under pressure, we usually go to our closest or our most reliable, I suppose, person in the lineout, and that has been Nicola Friday most recently. You know, she is a leader in so many aspects, but for the line out that is really her bread and butter and where she does really well. And so she's probably trying to take some of the pressure off her other players by calling the line out on her and making it easier for her hooker and the rest of her team. The problem with that is, as the rounds go by, other teams analyse that week in and week out, and recognise that, well, wherever Nicola Friday goes, the line out's probably going. And so they start to mirror that, and that's where we start to see then huge pressure on the hooker to do a perfect throw, or huge pressure on the jumpers to get her up really quickly ahead of the other team who are definitely going to contest.
And is it issues like that, small things that teams, as you mentioned there, teams pick up? And we've even, from week on week analysing the games, we're able to notice, you know, exactly what has happened with the likes of possession as well, who they pass to, who their only options are. Is that kind of a big downfall for this Irish team this year? They just don't have the options. Maybe they haven't had the time together to develop those options.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're a team that can only play one way and can't adapt to the conditions around you or to what the defence is showing you, you're definitely going to be hindered. And that's why our attack then becomes stagnant and we fail to get that go forward ball. You know, the best teams in the world have multiple options and ways in which they want to play. They either end up being a running team, you know, or a kicking team, or a mixture of both. And that really gets defences guessing. So they're not sure, do I shoot out of the line, or do I hang back in case a kick comes through? In terms of looking at it from an individual perspective, the best teams in the world and the best players in the world are the ones who have multiple options to them. So they can run, they can pass off both hands. They maybe are able to put a kick in behind, you know, they're able to bring it themselves, like carry themselves and then offload and make the right decisions. And that will come with time. But as I said, there is a bit of a duty of care for each of these players to go off and work on their own skills to improve themselves as a player. Because if every player improves themselves by even 2 or 3%, that improves the team by an awful lot more, which makes them a better, more cohesive unit.
And moving on then to the Scotland and Italy game, 29-21. What did you make of that match? A relatively close scoreline there.
Yeah, look, based on results that have gone previously in the Six Nations, that was a bit of a shock result for me. Not saying that Scotland didn't have the ability to win. They obviously did. But Italy had been playing some really good rugby. They looked like their depth was a lot better. You know, and they came out firing in that first half. Scotland had two players who were getting their 50th cap, Helen Nelson and Lisa Thompson, who just came back into the squad after the GB Sevens. You know, and then they were also boosted by the return of Jade Conkle-Roberts, their hard-carrying number 8, and kind of a talisman, I suppose, for that Scottish team. And they came out firing. They knew they had a job to do. Their forwards really beat up that Italian pack. They were much more physical, very, very dominant, and their forwards did a lot of the hard yards in order for their backs to have the freedom and space to do what they wanted. And Italy just looked like they were a little bit slower. The blocks weren't expecting this, you know, and got caught a few times. And big problem with Italy was their discipline. They had a yellow card, and then towards the end of the match they also had a red card, and those penalties helped Scotland. And Scotland have a very reliable kicker in Helen Nelson, who constantly was kicking for touch. And then the Scottish line out and Maul was phenomenal. Lana Skeldon at hooker was really, really good for them. She got 2 tries to boot in the game. But the forward pack just dominated for Scotland, and Italy only kind of came to life in the second half when we started to see what some of their backs could do, you know, and scored some of their trademark tries, kind of weaving in and out of a few defenders. But Scotland were well worth the win. I just thought coming into it that Italy actually had the edge on them.
And the France and Wales game, given how Wales have been playing this year, would they have been disappointed in that result?
Yeah, look, France playing some fantastic rugby, well worth the win. 39 points, I think 6 tries it was they scored over Wales. And look, that Wales team, they are a very good team, but I think they had one eye on this last weekend of games. So they probably recognised that they aren't quite at the level as what France were at, and decided to give some other players an opportunity and rest some of their frontliners who, you know, they want to be obviously at their best for this huge, huge clash this weekend to solidify that third place. And so France obviously, you know, dominated them, bullied them a little bit, were playing some beautiful rugby. Tremoulier at 10 is running the show in what was her last home game before she retires, and she got a wonderful send off, and the likes of Hermé in the back row scored a beautiful try, and they have a new winger coming through, Lorenz, who scored a couple of tries, and they just look like they're playing really nice, fast, free-flowing rugby. And they were boosted by the return of Romain Ménager, one of the best back rows in the world. She also got on the score sheet. And they definitely would have enjoyed that, and it would have been a really nice confidence boost leading into this weekend's game against England. Wales, on the other hand, you know, they'll look at that and analyse that game, but it's not the be-all and end-all for them. They kind of knew coming into that they almost conceded that game and rested their whole usual front three. And, you know, we saw in the second half that when their subs came on and their usual starters came on, that there was a definite change in intensity and impact. They started to be a little bit more dominant, and they scored a couple of tries and got on the score sheet. So I'd be taking that result, that French result, with a pinch of salt, because we didn't see the Welsh at their best and at their strongest. But I've no doubt this weekend we will.
One of the big talking points then from last weekend was that Irish game, and more specifically in relation to what we were discussing last week with the Telegraph report. We've seen players turning up with posters, essentially protesting, is what they were kind of calling it. The Independent done an article on it, the Telegraph done another article, and the IRFU confiscated these posters. So this led to a lot of, I suppose, people discussing it on Twitter and the likes. The IRFU said they were essentially confiscated because they contained foul and abusive language. Another spokesperson said after the game that they were aware of the protest, and while they mightn't agree with it, everyone has the right to protest. So what did you kind of make of it? People were obviously turning up with these posters to show support, but how do you think did they go about it right? And did the IRFU and the other side go about it right as well?
I think it's a really tricky situation. Look, obviously there are a lot of fans out there and supporters of women's rugby who are not happy with what they've seen and all the negative media and what they, I suppose, see as the poor treatment of the women's team over the last couple of years. And I suppose for a lot of people, that article by Fee Thomas in The Telegraph, where it was reported that there was a prominent member of the IRFU saying that he doesn't give a damn about women's rugby, that was kind of the last straw for people. And a group, I suppose, decided to voice their opinion and show that they do care, and there are people that actually care and, you know, do give a damn about women's rugby. And they wanted to, I suppose, show the IRFU that, look, we care and you should care too, and you should want to make a difference and change in this. From the IRFU's perspective and from Munster Rugby's perspective, because where they were playing, Musgrave Park was where Munster Rugby would have a couple of games and stuff as well. But I do understand the confiscation of the posters themselves. Look, we, I suppose, want to make rugby as inclusive as possible, you know, and we know that there are going to be children and young people at that game, and the IRFU, I suppose, believe that there shouldn't be a curse word in that, and that that's not something that we should want to be seeing or on TV and this, that and the other. I don't know, did they go about it the right way? It's a tricky situation. Look, I wasn't there. We're only hearing, you know, bits from one side and the other who are trying to, I suppose, protect themselves and look at their own best interests and give their own side the story. So I didn't see the protest, even though I was there. I'd kind of heard about it afterwards when it happened, and I've seen the media furor around it. I suppose a big thing for the IRFU is that they need to realise that, you know, people do care and support women's rugby, much like I know the IRFU do. But they just need the IRFU to have a response to this and how they're going to deal with it. I think the biggest problem that people have been having is that the IRFU have been quiet about all of this. You know, and I have heard reports that after the Six Nations, all of this is going to be addressed and they're going to outline, you know, their feelings around the whole negativity that's been going on and comment on certain situations. And then they also plan to have a review of this current Six Nations and how it's gone, but also a review of the whole professional setup and have they got it right. And, you know, I hope that they're willing to put their hand up and say, look, we didn't get everything right, you know, and we may have gone about this incorrectly, but that hopefully these are the steps we're going to put in place to change that, you know. So hopefully that review process comes through, that we have a spokesperson for the IRFU, preferably the CEO and someone like Kevin Potts, you know, or David Nusavora, who are giving us this information, because so far it's been very, very quiet in regards to all the negativity in the media and that article in particular. And people just want to hear the IRFU side in it, as opposed to just shutting it down a little bit. So I get why they've been quiet so far, because they don't want to disrupt the players and in the middle of a tournament and cause all this negative backlash on them. But I do think it needs to be addressed at some point.
And what would that match have been like for the players? You were down at the match. They probably have heard all these reports about this protest, and at the end of the day, people did want to show their support and do good for the players. But I was even seeing reports that, you know, they were trying to get players to sign these posters and then security were taken out of their hands. It must be very stressful to be in that Irish camp at the moment.
Yeah, so look, the players obviously would be very conscious of what is going on in the media and what's been said, particularly when it's around the organisation that they're representing and they're part of. It depends, like certain players take it in certain ways. Some players try not to read any media at all, whether it's about themselves or the IRFU, and just kind of avoid the situation. Others like to be well informed of what is going on in order to, you know, be able to talk about it if they want to and understand what exactly is going on. In terms of like players at the end of the game trying to sign things for people and whatever else, to be honest, most of the time when you're signing something, and this is from my own opinion and my own experience, is that half the time you don't actually know what it is you're signing, because mostly it's usually just a slip of paper or a jersey or a t-shirt or something like that. So again, I can't speak for whoever it was that was about to sign that particular poster, but I'm sure if they had known what that actual poster said, they may have maybe thought about it, you know.
And it puts them in an uncomfortable position.
It puts them in such an awkward position, because I agree, they obviously want better support for women's rugby. They want better attitudes towards women's rugby. They want the game to grow and improve, because they are players and they are playing and they are trying to improve women's rugby in Ireland. And they're caught between a rock and a hard place. The RFU are their employers, you know, at the end of the day. They are contracted. But also it is the fans that make this game, and the voluntary side of the game. And yeah, they want supporters to come, and they want a good atmosphere and a good rapport and relationship. But yeah, it's quite hard for the players. And I'm glad that that situation was taken out of their hands by, you know, the poster being removed in that regard. Because for the player, you know, if I had signed that not really realizing what I had signed, like, that could have put me in a really awkward position, you know, maybe going into the next game. And that's not something that players need to be worrying about or stressing about the week of a game or a couple of hours after a game. You know, that's, they shouldn't be involved right now, because, look, the game is the biggest thing.
You are watching the Her Sport Six Nations show, brought to you in association with Opal, a proud sponsor of Irish rugby. So then, looking ahead to this weekend, obviously the biggest games, I suppose, of the championship, deciding where each team sits at the table. And the main match of the weekend is, of course, England and France, both teams hoping for that Grand Slam. We've seen it be England, you know, every single year in recent times. But what do you think this weekend will look like? Will France be able to get ahead?
Yeah, well, look, I think, despite Ireland's struggles in this year's Six Nations, this is the first year that the very last round of the Six Nations has been exciting, and there's been something up for grabs for all teams. So in previous years, you know, it's just been whoever the top two teams kind of that are competing for the Six Nations. But this year, all teams have something to fight for in terms of placing and what that means to them at the end of the tournament. But obviously all eyes are on Le Crunch, as it's known, and England and France. You know, it's set to be a world record. Twickenham, they sold over 55,000 tickets, I think it is, which is absolutely phenomenal. And it shows the explosion that has been women's rugby over the last number of years, you know. And I really hope that Ireland can kind of benefit off the back of that and use this to really propel us forward. But two phenomenal teams going head to head. England probably have an edge in terms of depth. They've a lot of players returning from injury that maybe they haven't had over the course of this championship. And, you know, they have the amount of quality players they have that they could probably field, you know, an A, B and C team and still do well in this tournament. You know, but France have been a team that start a little bit slow but quietly creep up on you in this tournament, and you know they're always going to be there, thereabouts. They'll be coming into this off the back of that 39-14 win against Wales. Really, really confident. Managed to keep the majority of their players injury free, boosted by the return of the likes of Romain Menage, and they'd love to give Jesse Tremoulier a send-off. Out of all the years, this would be the year that I think France definitely are capable of winning. Just my head tells me that England have too much depth, too much classy players. And even if, you know, it's not going well with them with their first 15, the eight players they're able to bring off the bench would probably start on any other team in the Six Nations. And so they have the firepower to be able to kick on and win their, I think, sixth title in a row or fifth title in a row, which is crazy.
France have new coaches. They're under new coaches this year, and they have been saying they're very confident ahead of the match. They said they have the weapons at their disposal to spring a surprise. What would make this team, this French team, different than other years if they were to get ahead?
I suppose, look, they've managed to keep they've lost a couple of players, but they've managed to keep a real big cohort of experienced players. And as I mentioned, like, they were able to deal with the likes of Audrey Forlani coming back in and captaining the team, and keeping Gail Hermé, who is the normal or who was the previous French captain, happy enough and not like and confident enough to still be playing good rugby, you know, within the squad. So they've created this really good kind of leadership group almost that, you know, have the experience of coming up against this French team or against this English team and doing really, really well. And I just think their mindset seems to have changed a little bit. In previous years when they've played England, it's been a really good contest, but they've fallen off a little bit. Now I think they've really strengthened their depth a little bit as well, and just seem to be playing a really nice brand of rugby. And they seem to be playing with no fear. Like, they scored a beautiful crossfield kick try at the weekend, you know, and that's something I really want them to start doing against England and start to test them a little bit. In previous years, they probably haven't brought their A game when playing against England, and England haven't had the most of difficult days when playing. So I expect this to be a really tight contest, but England might just shade it.
And you mentioned there will be a world record attendance in Twickenham. I suppose in Ireland, we're so dominated by the Irish kind of culture around women's rugby at the moment. But what will the atmosphere be like over in England, and what will they be expecting from the match?
Yeah, look, it's phenomenal. So they're playing in Twickenham, and usually when the women play in Twickenham, they actually close off the top tiers of the stadium to make it appear more full. And actually, there's talk that for the first time ever, they're going to have to open those top tiers because the demand for tickets is phenomenal. And like, the only time that I've ever experienced that where there has been a demand for tickets for me was our World Cup opening game, which was in UCD. And I think there was only about 4,000 people there, but it was the first time that there was actually demand and people ringing up going, can you get us tickets? I can't get tickets anywhere. Previously, it used to be like, yeah, you'd be able to get them at the gate, no bother, like, or you could buy them right up to the last minute. And that for me was such an exciting feeling as a player, knowing that people were excited to come watch us and were expecting a good game. And like, to have 55,000 people wanting to do that, and the French travel really, really well. And, you know, I think the atmosphere is going to be unbelievable with this English team. And Simon Middleton's last game, you know, as well, they want to give him a really good send off. And I just think it's going to be a fantastic way to start off a game, you know, and Saturday should be a really, really exciting day for women's rugby.
And if you had to put a scoreline on it, what would you say?
I do think it'll be tight. I'm going to say 27-24 to England.
And then looking ahead to Ireland's last match against Scotland, how important is this for Ireland? If they did get it, it would mark their first win of this campaign.
Yeah, obviously, look, it'll be a great way to finish, a great boost to this team who've had a tough time over this tournament. You know, they beat Scotland last year right at the death with a try and conversion kick to win it. And that'll be playing heavily in their minds as well. But the confidence boost that this would give this team would be phenomenal. But there's more repercussions from that. A win with a bonus point for Ireland would basically push them up into fifth place above Scotland, or, well, depending on other results. But basically, it would mean that they have an opportunity to get into this second tier of the WXV tournament that's going on. So this new tournament starts in September. There's WXV Tier 1, Tier 2 and Tier 3. Tier 1 will be the top three teams in the Six Nations. So England, France and what's looking like will be Wales. WXV 2 will be the fourth place team. And either the fifth place team who have to do a playoff against Spain, and they will go into Tier 2. And then Tier 3 will be the bottom place finisher of the Six Nations, and then that loser of that playoff between fifth place and Spain. And basically what that means is this new tournament is where you'll be playing with countries from all around the world. So Tier 1 will have the winners of this specific Four Nations tournament that's going on between New Zealand, Australia, Canada and USA. And so the top three teams out of that will join in with the top three teams in the Six Nations. And it just means that they get, for the next 3 years, they get high quality games against those six teams, or against those five other teams that they have. And so you'll be playing against teams that are at a similar level to you, or a little bit maybe above or below, and just means it's a competitive game. And if you're playing against teams where you're really striving to improve, and if, for example, if Ireland got into Tier 2, which is our main aim now, we'd be playing against a team like Italy, who we know we can beat but also can beat us. You know, it'll be that loser from that Pacific Four, so a team like maybe probably Canada or USA, again, who are probably ahead of us in rankings and experience and skill, but would be a good challenge for us to play against and would make us better. And then also winners of Asia, so someone like Japan or Fiji, or kind of one of our Pacific areas as well. So if we get into that WXV Tier 2, we would have an opportunity to not only improve, but also actually win games and get a little bit of confidence. And that'll be like that for 3 years. So if we end up, the negative side of this is if we lose at the weekend, or if we come in sixth, We go into tier three of this WXV and we're stuck there for 3 years. And unfortunately, because of the lack of depth in women's rugby as a whole, the drop off from tier two to tier three in standards is massive. And so if we end up in tier three, the likelihood is we're playing against teams who are way below our current level and that we would probably beat with ease and we won't get a lot of learning and development from it. And we're stuck there for 3 years. That directly impacts our World Cup cycle and our ability then to be prepared for World Cup qualification in 2025. The three-year rule is only for this first cycle, and after that there will be relegation and promotion for each team every year into the three tiers. But the ramifications for having a poor tournament this year could be costly for Ireland, and I really, really hope they can manage to clinch that fifth place, get that playoff spot against Spain and hopefully beat them and get into tier two, which will be a very good result for us.
And is there not benefits? Well, you've outlined the reasons there, but is there not benefits for being in that maybe bottom tier if we are winning all those matches and gaining confidence? Or do you think because of that 3 year period, it wouldn't serve us in the long run? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, if it was 1 year, it wouldn't be as big a deal as it is. Yeah, look, what's the harm? We beat Sweden 45-0. We beat Kenya 55. You know, we beat, who else meant to be in Brazil, I think, 35-5. That's not the end of the world. Three wins, happy days. We probably get to cap new players. They get minutes, which is what we need. However, that's nearly almost like false positivity for us, because we know that if England or France were to play those teams, they'd probably beat them 100-120-0. And what we need, particularly for our attack, which has been our issue, is that we need enough pressure from a good defence to force us into making good decisions. Like, you want your 10 to be under a certain amount of pressure so they can learn and develop as a 10. Whereas if your 10 hasn't got much pressure because the defence isn't really good, you know, then they're going to look like they're brilliant, but when put under pressure in a higher standard of a match, are probably going to crumble because they're not used to it. So we need to have, a competitive edge or a level to some extent and have a certain amount of pressure put on us so that we can actually find out really what standard we're at. Because it could be all well and good. We go into that WXV Tier 3, do really well, win all our games by a landslide, and then go, do you know what? We could be really good. Let's play England in a friendly. And then turns out we haven't really improved too much, or that gap has widened. We want to, close that gap. And the only way we do that is we improve by playing teams that are at a similar level or slightly above us.
So the Irish team will be aware of that heading into this game. From the Scotland side, what are they playing for? What does it kind of mean for them to get this match?
So they're kind of in a similar boat in that their result and other results can push them into either third, fourth, or fourth, fifth, and sixth place. You know, a win for them solidifies fourth place and makes them sure that they're into that tier two tournament. A loss and they could potentially end up in tier three and end up in last place. And so they'll be very, very confident, coming in off the back of that Italy game where nobody probably really gave them much of a chance. But they'll be wary of the threats that we have as well. But Scotland's lineout and their lineout mall is very, very good, and they're very experienced in that area. They targeted us last year very effectively in the Six Nations, and I'm sure they'll be looking to see that that's an area of weakness for us, and we'll come into that. They have the added advantage. They already have a bonus point from their previous games. So they have the slight edge on us coming in that regard, and that they're not under as much pressure, but they still would like to win to solidify fourth place.
And what Irish team would you like to see this weekend? We know a few people got some knocks, but they seem fit to line out again. So who would you like to see?
Yeah, look, I don't know. I never seem to get any of these right. I said there probably wouldn't be many changes last week, and there was a couple there, all right. Obviously, I presume Dorothy Wall will come back into the squad in some capacity if she is injury free. But I was really impressed by Brittany Hogan at six. I thought she did a great job in the mall. She got a couple of turnovers in that regard, and I think it would be slightly harsh on her, to be honest, if she was dropped from there. Nicole Cronin was thrust back into the replacements because she was apparently back from injury, but then didn't feature and got injured again in the matchday squad or in the warm-up. So I doubt we'll see her again. I think Ailsa will keep her place on the bench. To be honest, again, the centre partnership is an area where I'm just not sure whether we have the right selection there. You know, I'm not saying that these players shouldn't be there. I'm just saying I don't know if we've got the mix right of who we should have. And I suppose when you look at our backline as a whole, it's very inexperienced, and I'd love to have someone in there who does have that experience. We're probably just lacking in that a little bit, particularly with the loss of Enya Breen. He'll probably go with Anna McGann again, or Vic Irwin, like one of those two will come in. But other than that, I'd say the backline remains unchanged, because I thought Lauren Delaney was really solid at fullback, bringing in that experience. But I can't see him making too many drastic changes at this point.
And then the final match, Italy and Wales. You'd imagine Wales will get this fairly easily, given their achievements this campaign.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I spoke about this before. Italy's biggest problem is their inconsistency. You know, I really thought they'd go out and beat that Scotland team based on what we had seen from both teams prior. And then they came out, they were sluggish, they were ill-disciplined, they were inconsistent. You know, their handling wasn't brilliant, and Scotland just, you know, threw them around like ragdolls, really. So if Wales come out and play the way they did against Ireland in that first game, and the way they did against England in the first 20 minutes with their hard hitters, they should win this game easily. And there's something huge at stake for Wales at this point. Like, third place is there for them. They want to solidify that. They don't want to, you know, give that up in any respect, or even finish their campaign kind of in a defeat to a team that they should be beating. Italy, on the other hand, they could come out firing. They could come out with their players, you know, all on the same page. And they're capable of scoring some really nice tries and getting a result. But I think Wales will win this.
Before we head into the final part of the show, we are doing our Break It Down segment, where we give Hannah 60 seconds to explain rugby terminology. This week, Hannah, we're going to be talking about the defensive line.
Okay, so I suppose the defensive line's job is to put pressure on the attacking team and try and force them into a mistake or force them back. Ideally, a defensive line, you know, comes up together. The teams usually have a call, and they will all come up together in one uniform line, not trying to break that line at all. Where defensive lines can go wrong is if players come up and some come up faster than the others, and that creates what's called a dogleg, where one player gets in front of the other. The issue with the dogleg is it creates gaps, and if an attacking team is good enough, they'll take advantage of that gap. Big thing about the defensive line is communication. While this is happening all at the same time that you're moving your legs and you're trying to identify what's happening, you need to be communicating to say who has which player, who has ball, who has switch. And you're trying to force the team basically over to the sideline, where you could potentially make a big tackle and get a turnover. So, defensive line is on top when they have the attacking team going backwards and they're putting massive, massive pressure on a team. Boom, 59. Under 60 seconds for once.
So for the final part of the show, we're going to be discussing our fantasy rugby. So Hannah, how did you get on last week?
Italy messed me up last week, to be honest. I kind of backed Italy to do really well against Scotland, and that didn't come out as planned. They had a few Scotland players in there. They did all right. My French players, Vernier, you know, she's my go-to. She did really well. And I had a couple of English players in there who scored some tries for me. So not brilliant, but I was happy enough.
So for this weekend, if you had to give people five people they should have on that team, who should it be?
Look, obviously your English and French players should be in there. Marley Packer, if fit, scores a couple of tries for me. Vernier from France. I think Abby Dow on the wing, you're crazy not to put her there. For me, Sam Monaghan, she's made the most offload. She makes things happen from an Irish perspective. And for Italy again, or sorry, Tupelutu for Wales would be the fifth for me. She's been a cracking player and definitely one to watch.
And the games, in terms of the games to watch this weekend, there is only one, do you think, that England and France match?
I think the beauty of the games this weekend is they're all on Saturday and they're all one after another. So you could start with one and literally watch all three. And because there's something at stake for each team because of this WXV tournament, you know, any of them that you watch will be high intensity, high skill, and, you know, and there'll be a huge atmosphere. But look, you can't look past a world record grand slam for both teams on the line with La Crunch and France England.
And as you mentioned, all those matches take place on Saturday, with England and France kicking off at 1 o'clock, Italy and Wales at 3:30, and then the Ireland and Scotland game at 7:30. So that's all from us today, and you can catch the recap of those matches next week.